Colliding, written by Julie O. Petrini, read by Tabitha Petrini. I knew who Tim Davis was in high school, but I didn't introduce myself to him until my mom ran him over with her car. And this is not some kind of meet-cute story where her tires caught his foot as she slowly backed out at the grocery store or something. Rushing home on a drizzly November evening from a place she should not have been, my mother mowed Tim down as he rode his bicycle to work, paralyzing him below the waist. Tim was a year ahead of me at Westfield High. He was long and lanky, with dark hair that hung over one eye, so he'd always be combing it back with his fingers in a way that really got to me. He was a running back on the football team, the center on the basketball team, and he could have played baseball too, but he needed to work after school at least part of the year. He took AP classes, and he was not a jerk. He dated cheerleaders and pom-pom girls, the nice ones who remember your name and say hi when they see you at the mall. I was, well, the kind of girl who cared whether a cheerleader said hi to you at the mall. Needless to say, we did not run in the same circles, and I never really considered him as anything but a sort of minor god until my mom put him in intensive care. At that time, I was a first year at the university, and Tim was a sophomore at Westfield State. By Thanksgiving, Tim was in critical condition. My mother had moved out of the townhouse I grew up in. My dad was wrecked, and I'd stopped eating. My dad and I staggered through the holiday without her, pretending one of those dried-out turkey breasts stopped to shop keeps under heat lamps was edible. We'd always celebrated this holiday just the three of us, which might have been okay when I was little, but had evolved into a trial over the past few years. My dad would be cheering, fawning, toasting his girls, and insisting on gratitude rounds before we were allowed a bite of anything. My mom would force a smile. I'd force the food down my throat and then maybe later force it back up again. This year, my dad and I skirted the moment of the toast by grabbing our forks and stabbing at the sad lump of bird in the middle of the table. We forewent the gratitude round too. By Friday, the local paper had an article about Tim's condition, and I was hungry for details about how Tim was doing. The ink of the front page blurred as I read and reread that Tim's neck was broken and he was not able to move his legs. I laid awake all night, hearing the thud of impact, seeing the tangle of wheels, feeling the snapping of vertebrae. I kept reaching for the back of my neck, then pressing the intact notches of my spine and wiggling my toes. By Saturday, I stood outside Tim's room at Westfield Memorial. I knew the layout of the hospital because I had volunteered there in high school. I followed a distracted doctor through the locked ICU sliders and easily found Tim's door. It was covered with Westfield High and state pennants, each filled with messages and hearts and X's and O's. It was early. I was hoping to beat his parents and whoever else I figured would be spending the day with him. The curtain was pulled back and I saw Tim lying flat with an iron halo bolted into his head and neck. Luckily, I had nothing in my stomach. A nurse approached with an understanding crinkle in her eyes. "You must be Cammy. I'm so glad you've come. He's been asking for you." I opened my mouth to correct her, but she kept going. "It's okay. This is tough, and it takes some people a little longer to get their heads around it. At least you're here now." So, I thought, Cammy the cheerleader isn't that nice after all. Almost a week he's lain here, and she hasn't deigned to come by. The nurse said to Tim, "Look who's here," and left us. Tim's eyes were oddly bright, and I could tell he sort of recognized me, but had no clue from where. "How's it going?" I asked stupidly, standing over him. "Killing it." He studied me. "I'm not placing you." "I was a year behind you at Westfield High. Molly McCraw." I said a silent prayer of thanks that my mom hadn't changed her name when she got married. "Oh, yes." He looked up at me politely. As I said, not a jerk. Here he was with no feeling below his waist, waiting patiently for this mousy girl that he murkily recalled bumbling past him in the hall 2 years ago to explain herself. My old crush, my new guilt, the shock at seeing industrial screws drilled into his skull sloshed around in my head, then spilled out of my eyes in giant glops. In one breath, I said, I am so, so sorry this happened to you. I can't even imagine what you are going through. I've wanted to come see you ever since I heard because I remember you being a good guy and it's just so freaking unfair and I wanted to check and see how it was going for you and it was my mom who did this to you. His eyebrows went up at that last part. It's not your fault. He grimaced slightly. It's not even her fault. He told me to sit and I think to cut me off from asking him unanswerable questions, started asking me about what I was doing. I'm not sure he realized what he was in for, because my brand of awkwardness leans heavily on random babbling, so off I went about whatever. The spooky gothic history building on campus, my pledge not to pledge Greek, my roommate's wacky sense of fashion. Half an hour later, the nurse tiptoed in and said that she hated to break up our date, but Tim needed to rest. I got up, unsure of my next move, and Tim said, without irony as far as I could tell, thanks, Molly. That was strangely entertaining. Come back, okay? I nodded and left, avoiding eye contact with the nurse. I couldn't bear to see her disappointment that I wasn't the long-lost Cammy. I went back every Saturday until Christmas break, borrowing my roommate's car to cover the 90 miles from school, fueled by black coffee and not much else. I didn't tell anyone about the visits, and I don't think Tim did either. I'd arrive early or hide behind a magazine in the waiting room until I saw his room empty. At first, the only stuff he'd say about himself had to do with school. Then, in small flashes, he started talking about his injury. First, vaguely, well, that's over, about how he and his brother would run charity 10Ks, trying to fake each other out that they weren't really trying to beat each other across the finish line. Or, back when they followed instructions, glancing down at his still muscled leg shrouded by the sheet, I could make it across campus in 3.5 minutes. Then, the last Saturday before Christmas, as I was standing up to leave, he told me that one doctor said he was unlikely to walk again. I fell back down into the plastic-coated cushion of the chair, and it made a very realistic fart noise. He laughed, so I laughed, and then we both teared up. On the day before I headed back to school in January, Tim told me about what was next. Surgeries, physical therapy, maybe stem cell treatments, and tests, endless tests. He wasn't saying it in a way to make me feel sorry for him or guilty. More like, here's what's ahead and I'm on it. I know he got down sometimes, and some mornings I could tell from his bleary eyes that he'd spent a wakeful night, but he didn't give in to it. You suck it up, he told me once, or it'll suck you down. I told him I was looking forward to seeing his progress. He said, Molly, you can't keep doing this. What's this? Spending your first year weekends hanging out at a hospital with a crip? He'd never used that word before. And I looked at him like, really? You're going there? I don't think of it that way, I said. I think I get to see my friend Tim on Saturdays. He shifted his eyes to make sure they caught mine head on. Well, friend, then you have to figure out how to start eating again. I felt myself redden. No one else had noticed that I had been losing weight. My dad was in a funk about my mom. Most of the girls I knew at school had their own variations of food and weight fetishes, and my wardrobe was designed to obscure, not accentuate. I admit, I secretly was impressed at how little food I was consuming. It was less hassle than the purge technique I'd used in high school, and I didn't feel hungry. Depleted, maybe, but between my family, Tim's condition, the exams, was it any wonder? Tim didn't wait for me to stumble through feeble denials. He just said, in that kindly way of his, I like you, Molly, a lot, and I like you visiting me. Then, firmly, but I have enough of my own crap to deal with, and I can't be worried about what this is doing to you. Don't come back until you've gotten some help. Tim's ultimatum had effect. I found a therapist at school, an older school marm type named Marilyn with cat-eye glasses, so out of style they were practically in. She asked open-ended questions, which to me was like an unlatched stall door for a horse. The first sessions, no surprise, focused on my mom and how my dad kicked her out after she ran Tim over. She had to fess up to the police, then to my dad, about where she'd been that day. A hotel room with a guy she met in a bar that same afternoon. Not the first, apparently. My dad and I were both flattened. The air sucked out of us. I told Marilyn that my mom was never the cozy, nurturing type by any means. She's sort of removed, but I'd always thought she loved us the best she could, and my dad certainly had it bad for her. Marilyn asked me how I experienced the relationship, and I had a hard time putting it into words, until I flashed to a time we went to pick out a puppy at the shelter. There were two scruffy terrier mixes that fit our criteria, and they were both adorable. I watched them in the pen for the longest time. The black one kept leaping on the tan one, tugging its ears, nudging it with its nose, waiting to tussle or run around. The tan one just hung out, accepted the attention, and even wagged its stub of a tail, but wouldn't join the fun. We left without either of them, and my mom and dad didn't understand why I seemed to lose interest in bringing one home. I remember thinking that it would be like choosing between my parents, and I couldn't do it. Now it seemed I had chosen, or my mom chose for all of us, more like it. She had severed the already thin strands of tissue that connected our family. Not just with the accident, but by the breach of every one of those hookups, the misdirection of her limited capacity for warmth. I'd replay over and over my conversation with her the morning she left. Standing against the counter, dry and rigid, she'd sipped her coffee and told me she was sorry for what had happened, sorry for Tim, for my dad, for me. But she didn't explain, didn't answer my questions, didn't wipe away the drench of embarrassed tears soaking my pajama sleeves as I bent over the kitchen table. My dad came down only after she put her cup in the sink and slunk out the door. He stood over me with one hand on my shoulder, the other pressing back his own tears. I hadn't spoken to her since, and I told Marilyn I would never talk to my mom again. Marilyn said that was an option for me. What wasn't optional, she said, was conquering the notion that starvation would make any of this better. It was time to start nurturing myself. We talked about Tim, too. How my hanging around Tim was so sins of the mother laid upon the child. I accepted that was a piece of it, but there was more to it than that. Pointing to a swelling tidal wave in one of the photos on her wall, I told her I was thinking along the lines of a reverse chaos theory. From random cataclysm, connections emerge, synergies are uncovered. Instead of the fluttering of the butterfly's wings causing the tsunami, it's the tsunami revealing the butterfly. By late winter, Tim had the halo off, had made it through the surgeries to stabilize his vertebrae, and had been transferred to the rehab facility. As far as I knew, the doctors weren't saying much more about Tim's prospects of walking, but they must have told Tim to stay ready. Or maybe he decided himself. At rehab, he took to riding his bike, called an electric stimulation cycle, that used electrodes to send shocks to his legs, making them contract and pedal. It was a sight. He also did upper body work and all the occupational stuff he could to get independent. He made his own declaration of independence, he told me. As a way to prove to him I was working through my eating issues, I started bringing in the fast food he was always craving. One Saturday in late March, I brought in his favorite, Taco Bell, and the waxy smell of the overprocessed beans and rice filled his room, mixing with the scent of gauze and disinfectant. We didn't notice it while we ate, and I did eat it, but the nurse walked in and fake gagged. That got me started on a real gag, and we had to get some air. We wheeled down the hall to the elevator, got out at the lobby, and headed straight through the rear double doors to these sweet paths they had in the back. We'd been out there before, following the same route, and he loved to show me how he could do it faster every time. That day, he picked up such a clip that I couldn't keep up, even at a run, so he said he'd slow to a more conversational pace, which I took as an invitation to keep on talking, talking, talking. I was rambling about Samuel Johnson and how he would walk all night through the streets of London debating politics with his vagrant friends, and he broke in to tell me that Cammy came to see him. That shut me up. I wasn't prepared to admit out loud what it was I felt for Tim, but I did not like the idea of this girl who had so completely dissed him in his weakest moment suddenly reappearing. I remembered her as super pretty with white blonde hair, porcelain doll skin, and sparkly eyes. So I got this archangel picture of her floating down to bestow her grace on him. "How was that?" I asked, trying to keep the judgy out of my voice. "Hard. She was sobbing." Tim had stopped wheeling. I felt bad for her. I kept telling her it was okay. "Just like my frickin' father. Guys are so weak about girls' tears. It's pathetic." I told her I understood how brutal this must be for her. She knew me as one thing, and here I am, another. What does that do to our plans? What does it mean for who we are as a couple? He looked down at his legs. Topics that swirl in my brain for a good part of every day. Trying to stay level, I said, "It figures you'd make it easy for her." "It isn't easy for her, Molly." He snapped like he had never done before. Not around me, anyway. This happened to her, too. "Oh, God," I groaned. I managed to get him upstairs without heaving. Neither of us spoke again until I was on my way out the door. "Sorry, Molly." I turned back to him with my bravest smile and bent towards him to give him a tentative hug. He put his head to my face, holding me there for a few seconds. I stopped going to see Tim on Saturdays. The Cammy news threw into full relief how bizarre my whole connection to him was. I wallowed for a few weeks and then figured I'd better suck it up. I didn't want to be just the daughter of my screwed-up mother or my wounded father. I didn't want to be just the friend of the guy my mirage of a family had put in a wheelchair. I didn't want to be the directionless, shriveling girl that I sometimes glimpsed in the mirror. When I called Tim to tell him that I was getting busy at school and wouldn't be around for a while, he sounded pissy. I tried to explain, without explaining, that it was hard for me to see him right then. The call ended in stone-cold silence, but he texted me 10 minutes later, "You'll be back," which both irritated and soothed me. My Tim visits had always provided fodder for a good chunk of my sessions with Marilyn, so when I told her I wasn't going anymore, she wanted to get into that. "Why does Cammy coming back into Tim's life affect your friendship with him?" "I guess I'm annoyed she could disappear when he was at his lowest and just show back up when he's getting better." "Is he getting better?" "Well, yeah, he's figuring out how to take care of himself, how to move forward, how to stay strong. He's hopeful."
"Sounds like the type of friend anyone would want."
I thought she had a point.
"Told you so," Tim said when I reached out not too long after that. But he didn't press me, and I was grateful. Soon we were texting a few times a week, check-ins about school or his rehab usually.
He called sometimes, I visited him when I was home that summer, and we settled into a mostly comfortable friendship. Cammy was definitely in his life, but I had a place in it too. Tim's parents had converted their house to make it work with his chair, so by fall he was back at home, taking classes at State, but still spending serious outpatient time at rehab. He told me about the workouts he put himself through and described an upcoming bone graft procedure. I asked him about potential downsides. The doctors routinely briefed him on the possible complications of his injuries and the risks inherent in his surgeries. Stroke, pulmonary failure, bone fractures, hypotension, hypertension, sepsis, blood clots, a list of horribles that must have haunted Tim at his lowest ebbs. But he was always dismissive, angry even, when I brought them up. "I have no choice, Molly. Forward is the only way my wheels roll." In late April of my sophomore year, we were chatting on the phone as I headed to the library. I told him I was dreading summer, living in our townhouse steeped as it was in memories of my mom, working my crappy waitressing job, biding time until the fall. I'd miss the buzz of classes, the cocoon of school. I launched in about the anatomy final I had coming up.
"Wait, you're taking anatomy? What's Miss English major taking anatomy for?"
He couldn't see me, but I stopped dead on the library steps and blushed so intensely I was sure he could hear it.
I don't know. Just seemed interesting.
"Molly."
"What?"
I said, talking loud and fast now, pounding up the rest of the stairs. "What's so bad about learning a little about this stuff?
All the talk of your rehab and PT and what your body went through and needs to do now got me thinking. I had AP credit for the science requirement, so they let me take an elective. I kept going. What's so wrong with that? I said again. It's interesting. Then, classic Tim, that is so cool. A few minutes after we hung up, I got a text from him. Hey, just thinking. They have summer internships at rehab. Apply. I could hear that nonstop patter of yours all day. I love the idea. Love the spark of direction I felt. I called my old boss at the hospital volunteering office for a recommendation. Tim put in a word for me, so naturally I got an interview. I was in. The work part of my summer went well. My job was mostly to set patients up, supervise their warm-ups, and prepare them for the hardcore therapy itself. I watched them push through pain and doubt to move a shoulder, extend an arm, bend a knee another inch. I watched tiny progressions mount up. Also, of course, I loved seeing Tim every day, and I even developed what my mother would have called a cordial relationship with Cammy. She overheard me craving a nice coffee one morning and twinkled in with one after lunch. I must have hesitated when she held it out to me because she said, "No spit, I swear." I had to laugh, and we were easier after that. The family part of the summer was not going well at all. My dad was still only half himself. He went to work every day, came home, and that was about it. He'd summon up some energy to ask me about my day, but in a hazy way. I still hadn't told him anything about my friendship with Tim, figuring it'd be painful for him. If he thought there was anything strange about my working at a rehab facility, primarily with people severely injured in accidents, he never said. Sometimes I wanted to shake him, tell him to move on, to suck it up. When it dawned on me that this might be his fate, the price to be paid for loving someone in a way they couldn't return, my stomach clenched. I wasn't dealing with my mom at all. I was still firmly in Camp Dad, but something about the way he was chained to his misery forced a tiny crack in the lockbox I'd put her in. I wonder how hard you can force a feeling on yourself or someone else. On the Friday morning before I was due back at school, I positioned Tim's wheelchair next to the stimulation bike. As I bent over to lock the wheels, his right foot twitched. We looked at each other. We looked back at the foot. We didn't say anything as he transferred himself over. He rolled over to the pull-up bar and said deadpan, "Molly, get Tanya over here." I hoofed it to the head therapist. "Tanya, Tim needs you." We walked back to Tim, who glanced down and said, "Watch." 1, 2, 3, he said. His foot moved a fraction. 3 sets of eyes filled. I will always remember the joy of that minuscule movement. It felt as holy as a resurrection. Even now, the moment lives as a testament to possibility. That night I drove Tim home, as I often did that summer. We had the windows rolled down and his right arm slung out the window, banging a fraction off time to the beat coming from the radio. He yelled over the music that he was going to crush BT on Monday. I wanted to remind him of Tanya's caution to take it slow, but his giddiness won me over as we imagined his literal next steps. We pulled into his driveway and I shut the car off. "Standing by Thanksgiving," he said. "I wouldn't put it past you," I said. He brought his arm inside the car and wrapped me in a hug. He held me for a long moment and I breathed in his shampoo and the evening air and his hope. He pulled back slightly. Then he kissed me on the forehead. I looked into his kind, honest eyes and nodded. Hauled myself out of the car to set up his chair and watched him power up the ramp. I heard Cammy's excited squeal from his parents' kitchen as he must have relayed his news. Then I drove my aching little heart back to my dad's. The screen door of the back deck of our townhouse was open when I got home, and I peeked out to see my dad sitting on the chaise, the newspaper neatly creased in his lap. He was looking out at the park that must have been a selling point when he and my mom bought that place 20 years ago. I felt a fresh wave of empathy for him. I grabbed two beers from the back of the fridge and handed him one as I sat on the edge of his lounge chair. We clanked the necks of the glass bottles and cheers, and after a few steps, he asked me about my last day. Appreciating his effort, I told him about one of the new patients I had helped, how I'd missed her but was excited about the progress we'd made together that summer. "And Tim?" he asked. The ball field was brown from a summer's worth of cleats and heat and maybe just a general lack of maintenance. A swing in the playground dangled uselessly, one of its chains rusted off. "You know?" "Of course I know, honey." I leaned into him and he scooted over, pulled me to his chest and kissed me on the forehead. I actually laughed a little at that, and then I told him mostly everything. How much it all hurt. Tim, Mom, him. I guess I expected an outpouring from him, a proportionate unspooling, but I got something less and more. "I'm so proud of you," he said. "And I'm so, so sorry." Tim met his goal. 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, he texted me a picture of himself, his long body upright, supported by a harness and heavy leg braces, his powerful arms clutching the metal railings of the standing frame. I whooped into the courtyard outside my dorm window. When his name flashed on my phone the following afternoon, I thought he was calling to give me every detail. But it was Cammie. With the monotone clarity of shock, she told me that somewhere in the night, Tim threw a blood clot, which caused a cerebral embolism. He never woke up. I don't remember the next days, except for two things. That same evening, my dad appeared at my dorm room door, unbidden and all-knowing, and drove me gently home. And at the service, crowded beyond capacity, Cammie found me, took my hand, and guided me to the front row, where I sat with her, Tim's parents, and his brother. It's a year later now on a bright November day, and I'm on a bench underneath the nearly leafless oak in the quad. I spend a lot of time here, just watching. This afternoon, the shadows from the trees and the buildings play among the walkers, joggers, a girl on crutches, a boy in a cast, hurrying along the network of sidewalks in front of me. I keep a lookout, always, for people on wheels. I think about crossing and colliding paths and interrupting patterns and chaos and fate. I wish I could say I've come to terms with it all, but the truth is I haven't. I feel empty. My phone buzzes in my bag and I pull it out to see a memory, the picture Tim texted me on the day of his last triumph. His hair flopping over one eye, he smiles directly at the camera. I punch an icon in my contacts, an emoji of a blonde girl with saucer-sized blue eyes and impossibly long lashes. Cammie picks up right away. "You got the memory too?" she says. "Yep, he's looking right at me," I say. "You keep telling yourself that, girl, but I'm the one who took the picture." We laugh. For the first few months after Tim died, Cammie and I talked a lot about our separate, shared grief, the chasm he left in our lives, how she and I both have always hated the food at Taco Bell. We've never really shifted to other subjects, and the calls have become less frequent, but I think we will always press accept for each other. Today, we chat about how Tim's parents and his brother are doing, and she reminds me of the upcoming memorial run in Westfield they've organized. I confirm I'll be there and tell her we should get a coffee together. As we are about to hang up, Cammie says, "He told me to take that picture, that it was for you." I took one more look at the photo and slide the phone back into my bag. A breeze detaches a few more leaves from the branches above me, and I watch them flutter to the ground.